My name is Patricia Kathleen, and this podcast series will contain interviews I conduct with female and female-identified entrepreneurs, founders, co-founders, business owners, and industry gurus. These podcasts speak with women and women-identified individuals across all industries in order to shed light for those just getting into the entrepreneurial game, as well as those deeply embedded within it. Histories, current companies, and lessons learned are explored in the conversations I have with these insightful and talented powerhouses. The series is designed to investigate a female and female-identified perspective in what has largely been a male-dominated industry in the USA to date. I look forward to contributing to the national dialogue about the long overdue change of women in American business arenas, and in particular, entrepreneurial roles. You can contact me via my media company website, wild.agency, that's WILDE.agency, or my personal website, patriciakathleen.com. Thanks for listening. Now let's start the conversation. Hi, everyone, and welcome back. This is your host, Patricia, and today I am sitting down with April Wenzel. April is the founder and CEO of Compassionate Coding. Welcome, April.
Hi, happy to be here.
Awesome. I am so excited to have you and kind of get into Compassionate Coding. I think that the impetus for the company is so fascinating, and I know that everyone listening is going to have a good time hearing about it. Really quickly, for everyone listening, the roadmap for today's podcast, we're going to get into April's academic and background and early professional life. Then we'll jump straight into Compassionate Coding and some of the things that she's doing there. Then we'll go and climb deeper into the questions regarding the history of Compassionate Coding, the who, what, when, where, why, and how of the particulars, funding, founding, all of that. And then we'll talk about goals that April has for Compassionate Coding for the next 3 years, in so much as scaling and things that really affect companies of its size. And then we'll round everything up with advice that April has for those in a similar position or looking to get involved in what she does. A really quick bio about Compassionate Coding. It's the ethos of the company is that software may be written on machines, but it's written by and for human beings. Recognizing this fact empowers Compassionate Coding to build stronger, more effective teams. At Compassionate Coding, we're transforming the culture of the tech industry with compassion through speaking, facilitating workshops, and providing coaching to software teams and individuals on growing their emotional intelligence skills using a combination of agile methodologies and the latest in positive organizational psychology research. So, and now a really quick bio on April before I start peppering her with questions. April Wenzel is the founder of Compassionate Coding, a conscious business that helps technical teams cultivate sustainable human-centered software development practices built on a foundation of emotional intelligence. She has spent the past decade as a software engineer and technical leader at various startups in Silicon Valley, building products in such fields as healthcare, education, gaming, and user research. As an advocate for more socially responsible tech industry, she also mentors technologists around the world and volunteers with organizations to teach coding to people from underrepresented groups. When not coding or speaking, she enjoys writing, running ultramarathons, and experimenting with vegan recipes. So that's fantastic. That sounds like I'm going to have a lot to ask you myself as a vegan, as a proud vegan warrior. Mm-hmm. So, April, will you drop us straight into your academic background and early professional life following that?
Sure. So I started coding in high school. And so then it was the natural progression for me to study computer science at Pomona College here in Southern California as well. And although I studied computer science, it was at a liberal arts school, so I got a nice, well-rounded education of, you know, the humanities as well, and I think that that's shown up in the work that I do now.
Yeah.
But so after that, I moved up to the Bay Area, because that's where you move when you study computer science, for the large part, and I got my first job at Sony, really big company, and it took one job about like less than a year at that job to realize I didn't want to work for a big company ever again. Uh-huh. And just a lot of bureaucracy in that. And then I moved on to startups. And then I worked at a bunch of different startups, as you covered in the bio, as a software engineer, you know, moving on to leadership positions as well. And I did that for about a decade.
Mm-hmm. And what, so when you kind of bounced between, was there a method to your different peppering of, I think kind of what people have discovered, especially, you know, tech talent and nerds, as I affectionately refer to them in the industry, is that peppering different industries, different from, let's say, different walks of life, actually strengthens, I think, a lot of software talent and offers this more landscape view than a lot of like people who are very microscopic in what they do and what areas they work on. Being able to mm-hmm. work in so many different genres, from healthcare and education to gaming and user research, it must have offered you this kind of larger view as to what your industry was all about. Is that, how was the impetus for developing compassionate coding? Were you peppering things from your past tenure of, you know, the decade you spent in Silicon Valley, or was it in reaction to those places?
Yeah, it was definitely, I often, you know, people might paint me as a job hopper, and I claim that title proudly because it gave me that diversity of experience you're talking about. And absolutely, that helped me see that the problems I was seeing in the tech industry actually appeared in all of these places. So it helped in that way. And then it gave me exposure to the fact that it wasn't one segment of the tech industry that was problematic. It was all of them. And like every company has room to grow. And so it was helpful in that way.
Okay, so let's climb into compassionate coding. Can you tell me when was it founded and how was it funded? Was it bootstrapped, seeded, investment, any of those things?
Yeah, so it was founded in 2016 in May. So I had just quit a job because I was kind of fed up with all the diversity problems and things like that, and just the culture of the industry. And I was like, you know what, I'm done jumping around and seeing the same thing everywhere. I'm going to start a company to fix this. And so that's why I started in 2016. And thankfully, at the beginning, I had savings from having worked at all these jobs, which, although they weren't very fulfilling most of the time, they did pay well. So I was able to save up money to start the company. So, but within you know, a few months, I had my first client. And that just came from publishing content about the issues that I saw and the solutions that I was providing to them. And so people reached out to me. So I didn't do any sort of sales or anything like that. I still don't. I put out content and I let clients come to me. And a lot of companies are seeing these problems on their teams, culture problems, diversity problems, burnout problems. And so they approach me. So within that, you know, once the clients started coming in, it's now self-sustaining. So I never had to take on funding, and I don't plan on doing that because maintaining control is really important to me because of the, you know, the essence of the message really comes from a place of consciousness and social impact and things like that are really important to me. And so, yeah, so I don't want to give that away in exchange for any funding. I have received offers, and even from the beginning, I was just like, no, thank you.
Too right. Yeah, absolutely. When you can bootstrap, I mean, I think even the most prolific, and as long as they're being honest, of VCs or angels would say, if you can bootstrap, do it. You know, everyone would argue that that's in your best interest. So when you talk about cultivating sustainable human-centered software development practices, and then you get into it's a foundation of an emotional intelligence, can you put that in some more like real life terms? I mean, we all are, I think, well, a large part of the industry in all of tech and startups in general are aware that there's been, for, you know, a millennia, this disconnect between the beast that is the business and the people that are working within it, you know, mm-hmm. and roles assigned and misuse of roles or talent or things like that, kind of disconnecting the fluidity and therefore bottom line of businesses. And it seems like your practices would touch on that, but can you point to kind of a little bit more of the structure of your company and kind of the services that you render?
Yeah, so it's true that it's a general problem in business. And it shows up specifically in software development because we do spend so much time communicating with our computers. And so it's, to give you an example, I was talking with a female manager on a software team, And I was talking with her and I sort of said, half jokingly, but I was like, oh, you have very strong emotional intelligence. Cause she said something that was, empathetic. And she said, don't tell anybody, it'll hurt my cred. Right. And the reason she said that is in software, if you're good with people, it's assumed that you're not quote technical, meaning that you don't have the technical skills, you can't code because you're good with people. And it's this seen as this very black and white thing. And so, you know, the problem is those same issues that show up in general business, if you don't have emotional intelligence, show up in larger degree on software teams, because it's not just not cultivated, but it's disrespected. And it's like, you know, women especially are so afraid of being seen as non-technical that they feel that they have to hide the fact that they are good communicators, some of them. I'm not saying all of them, but when they do. And so, so part of it, a lot of what I do, especially in the community outreach and in the content I publish, is making the business case for caring about this in specifically a software team. Because for example, if you're building for users and you're trying to negotiate with stakeholders, the project manager, marketers, sales, empathy is essential to be able to understand those needs. And right. That's a key part of emotional intelligence. So in these workshops, we break it down and say, okay, like here's a conversation. What are the different people in this conversation? What do they value? What are they looking for? What do they need? What are they feeling in this moment? And it's, you know, it's a novel concept in a lot of these software teams to even give any sort of attention to that.
Right. I'm wondering, going along the lines with what you were talking about with, you know, having this high EQ level kind of equating to a low tech, you know, level. Do you think that was a myth or that's propagated by the engineer, or that also got kind of attached to by management and is kind of expelled? And it's not dissimilar to the archetype of a computer, you know, tech talent being an 18-year-old boy with a hoodie in his parents' garage, you know, yeah. He's a white man. Like it's the most unrealistic archetype I've ever heard of. And I know a great deal of tech talent all over, but I was brought up in my career in Silicon Valley and nobody fit that archetype. And it was only ever working against the industry to pretend that was kind of our, you know, our mascot of some sort. And so do you think that it was, I guess my question is for you, because you've kind of unearthed this problem and looked through the different strata at the issues, do you think that it was started and only maintained by the tech talent, or do you think it was also heralded by management? This kind of disconnect between if you can communicate beautifully, you must not be good at coding.
Yeah, so actually, it's an interesting thing. It's a combination of both, but I've traced it back like through doing research and found this really interesting paper written in the 1960s, and it came out of a study at IBM for what makes a successful programmer. And the people who did that study, among other things, included, and I quote here, programmers don't like people. And that was included in the sort of profile of the personality of a strong programmer. Yeah. And I feel like we've been dealing with the legacy of that since the 60s, at least, mm-hmm. You know, probably beyond. And so the way this shows up in a practical way is in interviews. So interviews for software engineering jobs are still largely like, I'm going to watch you code the answer to this problem. And or either in person, like on a computer or on a whiteboard, which is very, not indicative of the daily work. And so it's really not a good way to evaluate the strengths of a software engineer, because in the real day-to-day life, it's much more collaborative and it's much more, you can look things up and it's not like, you know, what do you memorize and that sort of thing. But that sort of hiring practice will find you the people who like to code alone in a basement and don't talk to people because, you know, they'll just happily crank out the code for you. But are they going to be the strongest person on your team? Unclear, because they may not be able to communicate, you know, and things like that. Because those things are seen as, on some teams, nice to have, but like I said, on many teams as, you know, a sign that you're not, quote, technical, a term that I don't even like, because I think everybody's technical in some way.
Yeah, and I also think that the development of things like, you know, Agile and all of these new systems were kind of this bridge between, I would argue that the lone, you know, wolf backdoor programmer breaking into CIA for fun, all of those concepts are actually only maintained and well-sustained in a self-singular person company, because at some point you have to communicate, you know, and when that was realized in the early aughts, all of these companies started coming out with systems and programs that helped people communicate schedules, goals, you know, progress, those types of things, the hierarchies within those systems. And so I think that this was kind of on the horizon anyway, and chasing down IBM's, we should find out who wrote that and get them on a podcast series between you and I and find out why they've, you know, kind of hindered progress forever, since programmers that don't like people probably have bigger issues than programming at hand.
No, it's a very good point. And I will say, to touch on the Agile thing though, one problem there is that the Agile Manifesto was written by, you know, all white men and a large series of them. And it definitely does not address many of the problems we're still seeing in technology related to people. And it also, although it can help you collaborate to produce value, as they call it, in the system for the customer, it does not incorporate ethics or anything like that, which is also a big part of building for humans. And I think we see a lot of that in the tech industry, in how Facebook's been, you know, treating user data and all kinds of things. So
that's interesting. I didn't know that about Agile. I myself remember when Scrum made it into my household with sticky notes and stuff like that, as like a system that I was practicing, you know, on a personal level to see if it could help me like manage the soccer team of children I had running around my house and activities and things like that. It was genuine. And nerds would come over and say, "Is that Scrum? Are you doing Scrum for your?" And I was like, "Yeah, you bet I am." So
I love it. That's great.
Finding the, you know, who composed these things and whether or not we want to give our kind of dedication to people. There's no way, if it's written by all white men, it even describe the community in which it was written for at the time, let alone now.
Yeah.
With, you know, the era of visibility and inclusivity, ideally, theoretically, upon us. So can you claim how sometimes you, It's all about how much the change we argue. I mean, the voice is being there for inclusivity and things like that, but there's a lot of talk, especially in the higher echelon of management and things like that, as to how much difference it's actually making on hiring and the bottom line, you know, the real logistics of it all. Can you speak to, like, as of late, kind of when you come in to implement specific things, how do you root out issues that you then go into and kind of solve with this, like, emotional intelligence aspect?
Yeah, so, you know, there's a lot of common patterns that I see and that I saw for 10 years in the tech industry and then now with my clients. And so what I do is interviews. So in the same way that like designers do user interviews, I do that with the people on the team and leadership to understand where some of the gaps are, to understand where there's unproductive conflict happening on teams, to understand problems in their hiring process, problems of like stress and burnout and that sort of thing. And I do like very in-depth conversations with those people. And then that helps shape the content that I use in the trainings. To help provide an alternate way of doing things.
Right, absolutely. And so you go in and kind of self-diagnose per, it sounds like per patient, like per issue, per company. It's not just out of the box.
That's one thing that's really, I think, set me apart and attracted people to compassionate coding, and why I haven't had to do like sales pushes and things like that, because one, I have the experience as a software engineer who's, you know, has a background of maybe being also suspicious of these skills, because, you know, I took a while to sell me on the importance of this. So I'm able to use that sort of empathy for the techies who don't want to talk about people and their feelings and all of that. And then that's one unique thing. And the other thing is that I really do customize the content so that it will resonate with the audience, because, you know, there's so many emotional intelligence programs out there. And, you know, some of them are people find value in, and that's great. But a lot of them are that sort of like standard corporate, you know, I'm going to click through this deck and to say these things, and then that's it. And I try to make it a little more conversational. One, I make fun of it. Like, I joke at the beginning that we're going to start with trust falls, and I'm like, just kidding. And
I'm worried it's going to happen. That's fantastic.
Yeah, so it's fun. It's I try to make it fun for me and for the people involved, because I think that that's you know, especially with attention spans these days, it's important to keep some energy to it, so it's not just yeah, it's not just like kind of here's the science behind emotional intelligence and here's why it matters and here, you know, all these things. Like I cover that, but try to do it in a more casual conversational way.
Yeah, well, it must be changing. I don't know any of the statistics about it because I don't spend my off hours rooting out how it changes people's bottom lines, but it must be because it's the new buzz term in any system that's, you know, breaking a profit. And even in some startup circles that want to really configure properly. I've talked to a couple of startup female women identified companies that say, you know, we want someone to come in and give us like a diagnostics of the direction we're headed in right now, because we don't want to kind of integrate and weave in these problem issues until later on, and getting like an emotional intelligence program to make sure that we set out, I guess, a blueprint, if you will, of how to build. And I thought that that was a creative way of using it as well, but it must be changing not just the like the bottom line and ROI of companies, but also just the culture within it. I mean, right now everyone's all about retaining, right? There's not enough talent to go around. You got to keep your people happy.
And yeah.
So putting the right talent to the right work is what promotes, I imagine, more happiness.
Yeah, absolutely. And a great resource on that for people who are trying to make the business case for, you know, anybody in their company or to themselves that this matters. A great book is Awakening Compassion at Work by Monica Warline and Jane Dutton. They have done, it's full of like peer-reviewed research on things like that. And they specifically talk about retention, both of employees and of customers. Because as you can imagine, when you're compassionate with people, they stick around. It's logical sense, but it's funny that a lot of this stuff, to convince some people, they need the research. But I look at something like yoga, for example, which people have been benefiting from, you know, for millennia. And then it's like, oh, now the science says it's good for you. So now I'm going to do it. And it's like, okay, Certain things, yes. You know, of course, I love data. I come from a STEM background. I love that. But also if it's a small investment, which some, you know, initially it is some of these things, you know, to start valuing these things, try it out and see how it works, especially in your own life. It's a small investment. Like, I'm going to try incorporating these practices. Because to be honest, like, I like helping companies with their bottom line and, you know, in the sense that it helps. I only work with value aligned companies, or I try to the best of my knowledge. And so I want to help them accomplish the things they're trying to accomplish in the world. But more fulfilling for me is actually helping individuals be happier in their own life, because that matters much more to me than the profits of some company. But it's true that it also helps out with that. And that does, I think, initially draw a lot of people to it.
Yeah. And kind of reaching along those same lines of your, you know, where you're driven towards, you talk about within your bio about, you know, getting teaching coding to the underrepresented groups and populations, which is something I myself am incredibly passionate about. I think it's a way of stabilizing and equalizing some of the class disparity and pay parity issues that we have amongst not just gender, but different groups of people across our country as well as the world. Can you speak to some of the projects that you're involved that does that?
Yeah, absolutely. So one group I've volunteered with a number of times, and I highly recommend everybody support in any way they can, is Black Girls Code. So they have a number of chapters throughout the country that I know of, and it's really fun to volunteer. You help the girls build little robots or build a game in Scratch, and they're just so excited. So I sit in one of those, you know, I participate in one of those workshops, and then I hear, you know, some white guy that I'm working with say, girls just aren't interested in programming. And I'm like, you need to volunteer with Black Girls Code and see, or maybe not volunteer because you'd probably not be very encouraging, but at least observe what happens in these workshops, because it's just so inspiring. They love it. And it's not that we have to convince them to love it. They just love it. They love doing it. And so that's one that I love. As far as like women later in their career, or, you know, older women, I volunteered with Hackbright Academy as a mentor, and that's a great organization
that
helps women transition from another career into software development. Because, you know, although I also want to help the next generation, like I'm in this generation and I grew up and, you know, I studied computer science and I got in the industry. And so, you know, even if we get these girls in the industry, they're not going to stay in problems remain. And so I also really care about changing what's happening now and not just, you know, the next generation.
Absolutely. Absolutely, as do I. Do you, so for just to back up a little bit, Black Girls Code, I'm familiar as well, and I love, I adore trying to get the founder to interview with me. She's a busy woman, but it's for everyone listening. It's a nonprofit, and it's got a lot of different chapters. I don't know how many, but it's kind of dispersed all over the nation, and its drive is to help underrepresented populations get into the fun behind technology and coding, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's about right, yeah.
So it sounds like I haven't ever been to an event, but it sounds like they're sweet and kind of fun and age appropriate and getting young girls who wouldn't normally be exposed to technology and coding and things like that going with it. So if you were looking forward for the next 3 years, you're kind of in your idealistic, you know, vision board moment with Compassionate Coding, where do you want to see it in 3 years? Like what kind of metamorphosis or, you know, growth or whatever that might be for you would be ideal?
Yeah, so for the past 3 years, I've mostly been focused on in-person workshops with companies. And so I've built a lot of, you know, I've been able to tailor the content and understand like the pain points and all of that. And so right now, actually at this moment, I'm working on an online course to make that more accessible. So it doesn't involve me traveling all around. So it will help me scale in a way that's, suits my lifestyle and my preferences. And I considered a lot of options for that just for other people who are sort of interested in this sort of thing. Like you can, you know, train trainers and then have like that as your model. But for me, that just wasn't what I wanted to do. A lot of the value comes in the uniqueness of like even just how I present it and things. And I'm sure I could find lovely people to present it, but that would take the time that I'm and investment and oversight that I'm not really looking for right now. So online course seems like a great way to go. So I'm working on that. And I'm also working on a book for Compassionate Coding to, again, reach more people. And it's really about turning Compassionate Coding into a platform and a community for everybody who ascribes to these values. I was talking with somebody else, and she was like, everybody should be a Compassionate Coder. Like, all developers should go through this training because it will help be more effective in their job, be happier. Because that's the other thing. And this is how, although I'm very interested in diversity, and I think emotional intelligence is very important to growing diversity, a lot of times if I'm trying to convince like somebody from the majority overrepresented groups in tech to care about this, I lean on the burnout issue because a lot of people, even from overrepresented groups, are feeling burnout by the inhumane work style, like just this, you know, go, go, go all the time. Mm-hmm. And so emotional intelligence also helps with that. And so a lot of times we start from that, like understanding your own suffering, your own problems. And then, you know, that provides a pathway to, oh, other people are feeling this too. And maybe they're feeling it worse because they're from a group who has all these other, you know, things against them because of our society and bias and, you know, our privilege and whatnot. So that's kind of an entryway. So anyway, so yeah, I see it as like something that's just almost in the same way that like Agile moved things. It's kind of like that, like moving that sort of approach that it's not just like we add on, oh yeah, and then, you know, it's nice to have that they can talk to people too. No, it's like core. Like we put humans at the very center of every decision we make, even what framework we use, even which programming language we use. We think, how is this going to affect the people, both the people using the code and the people our users, and what features are available to them?
Yeah, I think, well, and I, for that, and perhaps this is my naivete, and I've come to this meeting here, and so I'll just go ahead and expose it. But it sounds like a fun cowboy, cowgirl land in so much as part of my chagrin in coming up in the Valley during the aughts was all of the perks to some of the change or the development of the nerd culture were actually totally built for mind control and enslavement. Now, you have to stay with me here. I swear, Google's campus came up while I was holding down Silicon Valley, albeit as a fashion photographer, but I was watching the development and I had a great deal of friends and investment and a husband that was coming up during that time period as well. And it was all built around keeping them on campus, like a cult, you know, and I've gone into these diatribes and blogs and things, so I don't care how much I demystify Google from loving me at this particular moment. But the idea that they were going to bring your dental appointments, wash your car, you know, keep your dog there, it was also, you never left Google. It was like your entire life was built on keeping you coding as long as possible. Free coffee, free food. Don't leave campus. You know, like it was terrifying to watch. And I kept telling people, it's not a perk. Like, it's this is crazy. And I think that it was seen as hysterically funny back in the day. But what I believe that your company and emotional intelligence programs are doing is kind of coming in, and or at least they have the freedom to do, which is evaluate, like, were the perks really perks? Did they actually approach, you know, all personalities involved?
Yeah.
Because keeping me in one geographical location for 24/7 is actually my form of purgatory.
Yeah,
it's like
I agree.
Where I die. And so for certain people, it works. They don't want to leave. They don't want the distraction. But this concept that we were bringing in this fun nerd, like, woohoo, we have a foosball table. Like, well, foosball for me is boring after two plays. Like, there's just different things that I think coming in and reevaluating the freedom that emotional intelligence programs has to evaluate, you know, all of those factors. And was it really fun? And was it exclusionary? You know, I've never walked in and found, I was just telling someone the other day, I've never walked into a new startup that had a huge infusion of capital and money. And so they have the fun little games and seen a quilting corner.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah.
Everybody giggles at that. And I'm like, it's no more funny than a pool table. Like, it's just another hobby that someone could have. It just, they were all developed and explored by these very exclusive measures. Mm-hmm. And so in doing emotional intelligence testing, I think that it reaches into inclusivity because it has to, you know, kind of suss out exactly what measures are in place to make people happy. And the freedom to do that is amazing, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. I agree with you about all of that. I mean, in terms of Google, and I also, I have said many critical things about Google. So I'm with you on that one. Not a very inclusive place. And what's funny is Google has, you know, they've had mindfulness programs and things like that, but ultimately that's the thing is, like, none of these are going deep enough to look at these, like, root problems of cultural issues, which is making assumptions about what people want, and then, like, one type of person, and then building around that, like you're talking about. In the tech Twitter verse lately, people have been discussing alcohol at tech events and how it's billed as, like, you know, oh, everyone, you know, there's a beer on tap in the office and everybody get drunk, and that makes women feel unsafe, for one, in a lot of circumstances. Mm-hmm. And that not everybody, you know, for many reasons, wants to imbibe that much in drinking, and that it putting that at the center makes it sort of alienating to others. And I think there's definitely something to that. And it relates to this idea of perks and, you know, who are we really serving with these perks?
Right. Because a perk at my personal company would be an all vegan diet. And I can guarantee you that 90% of the people out there would not feel like that was a perk, you know, but flipping things on its head. I had this dream one time of developing an entire empire based on, you know, on female centric, stereotypical female centric things, and then bringing young white men in and being like, it's a perk. We have a quilting corner. We have a vegan center. We support, you know, local nonprofits during our weekends with drives and food drives and things like all of these different things that people were doing in that were exclusive by nature, but pitched as fun and team building and very, I think, sarcastically opposed to inclusivity. So if you ran into a woman, a young woman identified or woman, let's say, over this weekend, and she came up to you and said, listen, April, just got, you know, my software development degree. I'm going to go up to the Valley. I'm going to pepper around some companies. I'm going to do some stuff. And then eventually I think I want to start my own startup. What are the key pieces of advice that you would give her, knowing what you know now about your history moving forward?
Yeah, I think one is trust yourself and your instincts more than anything else as a woman in tech. That doesn't apply to everybody, but I definitely think it applies to women in tech, because you're going to get a lot of advice from a lot of people, women with more experience, who have made concessions in order to fit in and have sort of made compromises that you may not want to make and that you don't have to make. Like just giving up some of the elements of your femininity. Like, I used to wear the hoodie and I used to dress that way. And I used to not talk about women's issues because that would make me, that would ostracize me. And I don't regret it because I have compassion for my past self, but I do think that if every woman acts like that, then nothing's going to change, you know, not to put the burden on women. But, I also think there's an opportunity here to, initiate change through cultivating your authenticity. So that's all one, which is just, you know, trust yourself more than anybody else. And that means ignoring a lot of advice that seems to come, you know, from people you might respect on some level, because it might not serve you. So,
right.
And I think another one is don't be afraid of leaving when things get toxic. Don't be afraid of being a job hopper. I was, and I never had a problem finding a job because software engineering is in demand. So, you know, a lot of people give fear-based advice on that, which is, you know, like, oh, you don't want to leave because that'll look bad on your resume. Like, I have not found that that's the case, because I don't want to work for a company who has such a narrow view of professional life to think that that's, you know, that that's like a red flag or whatever. Because also for women, a lot of times they have to leave because of like sexual harassment or even just being disrespected or underpaid or all these things. And so there's so many reasons to leave a job. So the companies you want to work for know that and recognize it. So don't be afraid to quit when things get bad. And I think three, it's never too early to start giving back, no matter how early you are in your career. And so, you know, especially this goes out to women who are in the like overrepresented group themselves. So like white women, to do what you can too as well to, you know, support people of color and people from other underrepresented groups in tech, because we still have a certain amount of privilege ourselves and we can leverage that to improve things for other groups as well. And so I think it's never too early to start thinking about that, you know, volunteering with groups like we talked about, but also just in terms of how we advocate. So in the same way that it's, we want male allies to advocate for us, like we're in a position to advocate for our colleagues and to amplify their voices. And I think that's important too.
Absolutely. And I think that that speaks largely to mentorship on a lot of levels. You know, I've talked to a lot of adults lately who talk about mentorship being this kind of like, I found someone doing what I wanted to do and I asked them to, you know, kind of be my mentor, which to me is plagued with a lot of weird question marks to begin with, but it's a random question and I've never gotten into it. But I think that giving back begins this mentorship, you know, model that can really be given openly. And I truly believe, I mean, it's the impetus for this podcast series. It's about developing a platform of any sort where women can give back via testimony, via story, via anything, you know, that might help other women coming up. And I wanted to wrap up with asking you a question that I negated to in the middle of it. Did you yourself, kind of getting into mentorship, were you ever moved? Did you ever find a system or a group of people that you identified with that helped you with your career, like with your trajectory, or have you been just your self-steered, self-motivated entity?
Yeah, it's funny because I often joke that my mentors are myself or books that I read, because I find that those are most inspiring to me. Like I read books and I see what resonates with me and then I apply that in my life. And so there have been great people, you know, through books that I've read that have influenced me. But humans, so I think it was Carol Adams, who's big in like the animal rights movement, and she wrote a book, but she was tweeting about something, and she tweeted an article, and she said, humans are imperfect, but like books are perfect, or something to that degree, meaning that books can perfectly live by values, but humans are flawed, right? So, which is so true. And so I guess I find comfort and inspiration and aspiring towards what I read in the books, you know, with a dose of self-compassion. Which I also got from a book by Krista Neff called Self-Compassion. But in terms of groups, I will say that because, you know, to be honest, like some of those groups, I'm in some of them, and I often try to provide encouragement and inspiration, but I don't get a lot from them in terms of encouragement and inspiration, only because, you know, there's a lot of fear and there's a lot of, you know, people who are afraid and who have like kind of made themselves small because of, you know, because we live in the patriarchy and everything like that. And so, you know, a lot of their limiting beliefs will sometimes they'll try to, like when I first started my company, I joined this group for like women, like a coffee group. And it was for women, you know, freelancers and entrepreneurs. And I started talking about what I was doing and they're like, do you think anyone's going to pay you for that? And like, I was like, that's not what you want to hear when you're first starting out. So yeah. I left that group. Yeah. Because, and they're not trying to be mean. It's like, it's their own fears projecting, you know, and I've come to realize that. So I have compassion, but I like did not want to surround myself with that. And you know, there are more inspiring groups. And I will say this, one that I've found now is the Vegan Lady Bosses group. So I'm part of that one. And if you're, since you're in San Diego, you should join it too. We have a local chapter.
I will. Absolutely. I love new meetup groups. I think I find the same, a lot of what you're talking about. You know, I worry about negativity reigning supreme. And while I still want there to be platforms where people can kind of air that amount, I have a very specific personality profile that deals more with give me the work to do, like show me the ladder to change and I'll start climbing it. So, and there's different needs for all of that, but I like that. And I think that you're right. The more women I've spoken with who talk about mentorship and things of that nature, they get very leery of saying, oh yeah, you know, I just found this one godlike creature that just gave me all of this wonderful information. Yeah. And I do think that as entrepreneurs, particularly as women or women identified individuals, you have to fight, you know, 14 times as hard to get to that particular place that you are. You have become kind of yourself assigned compass, you know, as to how to get through things. And I agree with you as far as books are concerned. I worry with young people who get too into the idea of mentorship. I always say, you know, you need to vet your mentors like you would vet your employees, you know, and this goes with VCs as well. And that's a whole nother diatribe one day I'll get into with you. But, you know, the idea that we're proclaiming anyone as smarter or more well attuned into directing you in your life is nerve wracking.
I agree. So
really
I agree.
Assign. And also don't apply your dentist to your florist.
Yep.
You know, like make sure you keep your self-appointed mentors in the lane they belong in and not just get into everything.
That's a really good point. I heard a metaphor from someone and I don't know who to credit on this, but it was like have a personal board of directors kind of, and they're sort of like leading your career. So it's not your official like company board of directors, but like, you know, have a, like a panel of people that you can kind of pick and choose, you know, advice from. And I think that, you know, that would address some of that. But ultimately, I think, you know, like I was saying earlier, like you're your final filter. Like if things don't resonate with you, like on a deep level, I think, you know, sometimes it makes sense to ignore, you know, what these supposed, like, yeah, like you're saying, like godlike figures say. Trust yourself, you know.
Absolutely. I agree. Well, three pieces of advice. Your first one was trust yourself. The second is don't be afraid of leaving a job when the time has come, and it's never too early to start giving back. And I think those are rad pieces of advice. I'm going to circle back around in a year and interview you again and see what's going on, because I think that your trajectory of doing online courses and stuff is definitely where the future is headed for a lot of industry. And so it'll be interesting to talk to you as you're on that new wave. And I just want to say thank you so much. I know as founders and CEOs, everyone's really, really busy. And I want to say thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and our podcast today.
Thanks for having me. Yeah, it's been a great time. Thanks so much.
Absolutely. And for everyone listening, thank you for giving me your ear. And until we talk again, remember to always bet on yourself. Slunching.